Firstly, I just want to thank everyone that has been participating and listening to Beaming Green. Your support has been invaluable and your feedback has been great as well. Now, I just wanted to let you know that I'll be having a 2-week break and back then with our final episode before Christmas to talk about what would be a sustainable Christmas for you and your family and what gift ideas have you thought about. So I'm looking forward to some of your suggestions so that we can share them on the final episode of the year on Beaming Green. And thanks once again for all your support. Hello, my name is Jeremy Melder, and I'm the presenter from Beaming Green. Before we start, I would like to acknowledge that this podcast is being held on the traditional lands of the Bundjalung people and pay our respects to elders both past, present, and emerging. The Beaming Green podcast is a weekly podcast which will help you to take out some of the stress and confusion about how to live your life more sustainably. And we do this by introducing you to people that have first-hand experience and expertise in all aspects of sustainability, so you can get some amazing insights of how you can implement simple and practical solutions to enhance your life and the lives of your family. Ever wondered what it would be like to be a beekeeper or have some bees, look after them, nurture them, collect some honey? Well, today we're lucky enough to have a representative from the Gold Coast Amateur Beekeeping Society, Leonie Schwarzel, who has been a member for a number of years, and she's going to share some of her wealth of knowledge with us on Beaming Green so that we can be more informed about decisions about becoming a beekeeper. Leonie, welcome to Beaming Green.
It's lovely to be here.
So, Leonie, we met at the Gold Coast Bee Club.
Gold Coast Amateur Bee Club Society?
Yeah, mm-hmm. The Amateur Bee Club Society. Was it about two and a half years ago? I'm just really keen. You've been a beekeeper for a while. You do our newsletter and things like that.
I do indeed. Yep.
What inspired you?
I was lucky enough to grow up in a rural environment. My parents had orchards, mostly stone fruit, and we used to have beekeepers who would bring their hives each year to pollinate our crops. And I would sit and watch from a distance. I was a little girl, and all beekeepers in those days were men with long beards and usually a cigarette hanging out of their mouths. And so little girls weren't encouraged, but I was just fascinated with what I could see. So I have always had this fascination with bees and honey. And we had roadside stalls that would sell all our fruit and other fruit growers in the district, sell all their fruit. And one of the products that we would sell would be all these different varieties of honey. And I'd line them up from the very lightest in colour through to the very darkest and have paddle pop sticks that people could use to sample the different flavours. And, I was always fascinated. So when I found out that there was such a thing as urban beekeeping these days, I had to skip forward 30, 40 years, and then I did a beekeeping course and started urban beekeeping, and then was very fortunate to come and live in the country. So I'm now on acreage and I've got lots of bees, and I work as a beekeeper for somebody else as well.
Yeah. I was very fascinated when I just joined. I think it was very newbie to the club.
Yep.
And you were talking about responsible beekeeping.
Yes.
And I thought, oh, I hear all this stuff on the news about, you know, there's a lack of, you know, bees in the environment and things like that. And then you see these things on the ABC that they talk about people that are doing urban beekeeping. And so you were saying that, you know, that we need to do this responsibly.
Absolutely. One of the questions that was asked in the course when I did my training a number of years ago was, are you a honey collector or are you a beekeeper? And if you're a honey collector, if you're in it for the crop of honey, then you're in it for the wrong reasons, because bees are animals, and fundamentally you're keeping, in each hive, you're keeping up to 60,000 livestock. So you need to be responsible for maintaining the health and welfare of that livestock. Whether it be cattle or goats or sheep or whatever, you are farming livestock when you have a colony of bees. Mm. So you have to take that on with a lot of training and education to make sure that you understand how that animal needs to be managed responsibly.
No, I agree with that. And I think, you know, what we want to inspire people in Beaming Green is to, I want to be a beekeeper, but to do it responsibly. So what are the steps in terms of I want to be a beekeeper? Obviously, we're talking here in Australia and it might be different in other countries, but, you know, I think we've got a pretty good training program here.
We do. We're very fortunate. We haven't, in most areas of Australia now have bee clubs, their local bee clubs. So the first thing that I would say to people is go and get some training. Don't buy your hive and your bees and then start reading or watching YouTube videos. You need to do it the other way around. So join a club. Go and do a beginner's course. Start reading some really good books, find a mentor, find somebody who is already beekeeping and doing it well, and ask if you can come along and give them a hand. Most courses that you can do through your local bee club are very affordable, usually done over a couple of days. You get a good theory, a good basis of theory, and you get a little bit of practical, and that just gives you an idea of what you're in for. And that's the beginning of the learning. From then on, it just goes on. Whether you're a beekeeper for 5 years, 50 years, 80 years, and I've met some that have been going that long, you are constantly learning. So education has to come first.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I'm really, I must say, I like learning a lot. And you've been a wealth of information. And Jim O'Regan is 84 years old.
Yeah, and Jim's been beekeeping for at least 60 of those 84, probably closer to 70.
He's got some, you know, great stories, and it's so much fun, you know, to go with that. So in terms of people learning environmentally, there's honeybees.
Yep.
And there's also
other bees. Australia is in a unique position in the world. We have the European honeybee, which has become naturalised in our local environment, and it's responsible for most of the pollination of our agricultural and horticultural crops. But alongside the honeybee, we have 2,000 species of native bees in Australia.
No way. Yep. 2,000?
And they're still discovering more.
Wow.
Yeah. So we are, most countries of the world do have native bees, but not in the vast numbers and variety that Australia does. Mm. Now, a lot of our native bees are not colony bees like honeybees. They don't live together in a large colony, a big family. Mm. A lot of them are solitary. So it's just a single female who lays a couple of eggs. She collects enough pollen and enough nectar to just put away some stores, and then she just covers up that little hole in the bank of a river, or a hole in a brick, or a couple of leaves that have been wrapped together and that she sealed up with propolis. Mm. And she goes off, and they have to raise themselves. And then we have some native bees that are also colony bees. They can be kept in a box, but they are tiny, tiny little bees, just like a little ant. And they live in a much, much smaller box. They don't produce a big crop of honey. The European honeybee has its name because it produces such an excess of honey. Most of our native bees don't produce much, if any, honey. So, you won't get a crop of honey off a native beehive, but you can watch them. Another advantage of those is that they're stingless. They don't have a sting. They won't hurt you. You won't swell up when you keep native bees. But they're in the minority of bees that are kept.
I've got a friend that's just down the road has native bees, and you know how they don't sting, but they do bite.
Yeah, they do. Mind you, their jaws are so tiny that they really aren't going to do any damage. And they're very cute, very sweet.
So if people are wanting to look at these things, is it worth joining a club?
Totally. A club is a great source of of training, right from the beginner level through to intermediate and advanced beekeeping. Most clubs also provide some sort of mentoring program. Mm. So if you do a course through there, there's a very good chance that you'll be assigned a mentor or two, or you can assign yourself to a couple of beekeepers within the club. They usually have facilities too that offer some sort of hiring system. So instead of you having to buy an extractor to extract your honey, you can rent through your club. They often have a library so that you can take out books and extend your knowledge that way. Mm. They have monthly meetings where they do all sorts of activities. Different ways to harvest your honey, all the different equipment. We've just had a visit to a queen bee breeder, which was really interesting. Mm. How to render all the wax, because when you're taking off honey, you also get some of the wax, and what do you do with that wax? Because that's a valuable product as well. So clubs provide a wealth of information and access to like-minded people who are really interested in the same hobby that you're doing.
Yeah.
It's just a wealth of knowledge and great people to be involved in.
I'd like to know a bit more about what the Aboriginal view is of.
Yeah, well, before the European honeybee arrived in Australia, which was around about 1822, it arrived on a convict ship called, I've forgotten the name, but I'll think about it as we go along. It arrived in Australia, the European honeybee, on a convict ship, and soon established itself in the Australian environment. But the Aboriginals have been in Australia for 40, 60, 80,000 years, and they used to work closely with the colony native bee, a species called Tetragonula carbonaria and Tetragonula hockingsi, two species that of native bee that live in a colony and do produce a small amount of honey, and the Aboriginals call them sugar bag bees. So they would get, they loved to get these, that little bit of sticky, sweet honey out of the hives. They didn't keep them in boxes like we do. The hive was generally destroyed in harvesting the honey. But the species has thrived in Australia, so there was always, the next colony in another tree that was available. Another thing that we started to discuss was the impact of European honeybees on some of our native areas. And there have been studies and a lot of anecdotal information from Aboriginal elders saying that the honeybee, it's present in areas of native bushland now that it wasn't some years ago, perhaps 10, 15 years ago. And what they're seeing is that there's a competition now for resources. So the little native bees, which are very, very tiny, they will forage very happily alongside honeybees on flowers. But when you've got colonies of 50 or 60,000 honeybees and a very small colony of native bees, then the lion's share, obviously, of that pollen and nectar will go to the honeybees. So they've started to notice that there's been a decrease in some of the native native bee species and an increase in the European colonies. European colonies do, one of the ways that they reproduce is to swarm each year, where they split off the queen from the hive and half the bees. And they'll go and find a hole in a tree that would generally be occupied by a possum or a little sugar glider, one of our little marsupial mammals, by a lot of our Australian birds, some of our beautiful cockatoos and rosellas and so forth. And the native flora is being expelled by the intruding honeybees. So there's a bit of a concern about this change in habitat. And along with that, there are certain species of trees that can only be pollinated by natives and not honeybees. So they're seeing a shift in some of the types of trees that are appearing in these, very, very old, ancient areas with a fairly delicate ecosystem where the honeybees are pollinating trees that are now producing more seed, and those trees are becoming more established. And some of the shrubs that are pollinated by the little native bees are tending to, they're seeing less of them.
Mm.
Yeah, so it's a bit controversial.
It is a bit controversial, but it's kind of like, I would say, we need some sort of evaluation system, don't we?
We do, yeah. And the jury is still out on this. You know, as I said to you, a lot of this is anecdotal at this stage. There's not a lot of scientific research to support it. There is a movement in Australia to exclude honeybee managed colonies. So this is bees in boxes, in hives, that are managed by professional beekeepers when they're not out on pollinating some of our main crops like almonds or canola or avocados or passion fruit or stone fruit. Those bees have to still be collecting pollen and nectar to feed their hive.
Mm.
So traditionally, a lot of our professional beekeepers have had, well, they pay fees to access national parks and state forests, and they move their hives into those areas.
Mm.
And there is a move at the moment to perhaps exclude the honeybee in boxes from those areas of native forests. There are feral colonies, ones that have actually swarmed and set up on their own. They are talking about limiting the number of commercial licenses to those ecosystems. Yeah. Yeah, but it's very difficult because if you've got, you know, 1,000 hives, 2,000 hives, they need to be fed. So and our native forests in Australia, we have vast areas of national parks and state forests, and they are very, very wonderful source of pollen and nectar.
Mm.
So it's quite a controversial.
Very controversial. So if I guess what we're trying to say here, or you're trying to say, is just to be mindful of, you know, if you want to do this as a hobby,
yes,
just to be aware of how it could impact in terms of your environment around you, and just evaluate your environment.
Yeah. Well, what we're also finding is, you know, if you're living in an urban area rather than on an acreage out in the bush somewhere, urban bees do extremely well.
Mm.
And the reason is because most people have a garden.
Yeah.
And most people have a few trees in the garden. So, but urban bees don't have to travel great distances to find a good tucker, good food. If you want to help bees and you don't want to keep bees, plant lots of flowers, plant some flowering trees, put in some fruit trees. Your bees will absolutely love it, and everybody else's will. They can travel up to 5 kilometres to find food. And in urban areas, they don't need to travel that far and they don't want to travel that far. Mm. So, you know, if we can just plant really good gardens and lots of trees, and we have beautiful parks, that's the way to help the honeybee in urban areas.
Mm.
And, you're not impacting on these areas that are delicate and environmentally sensitive and, that the honeybees don't necessarily belong there. They belong in a box in a backyard with a beekeeper who loves and adores them and is doing a great job of managing those and taking off a bit of honey as a reward.
Yeah.
Take care of your bees and the honey will flow.
I think that's really wise words there, you know, because you do need to look after them, because there are pests and diseases, isn't there? Are you able to talk about some of those pests and diseases?
Yeah, yeah. There are a number of pests and diseases that will affect the European bee that don't affect our native bees.
Mm.
A couple of them. In Australia, probably the worst worldwide at the moment is something called Varroa destructor, a very scary name.
Sounds like a cartoon character.
It does. It would make a great cartoon character, actually. It would be such a baddie. It's a little tiny mite, and it lives on honeybees. It lives on their backs, and it lives in the cells of the baby bees when they're still at that little grub stage.
Mm.
And basically it sucks the goodness out of them, and in return it injects a whole series of viruses into that larvae. So it does kill a lot of the larvae, and the ones that do survive quite often then end up with things like deformed wing virus and a whole series of bad viruses. Now, we're extremely lucky. Australia is pretty much the last refuge on the planet that doesn't have varroa mite. So we're in this incredibly fortunate position that the worst the worst thing for honeybees in the entire world. We're currently free of it. So probably the worst one that we have is something called American foul brood. Now, we can't blame the Americans. It was just that it was named American foul brood.
Oh, really? I was blaming the Americans here. I'm sorry, America. I didn't know that.
No, it was just diagnosed there originally. So we have this American foul brood. We have another condition called European foul brood. And American foul brood in particular, it's a bacteria that breeds in a spore that can live in a hive for up to 50 years that we know of. So 50 years, and there is no cure for AFB, American foul brood, AFB as we call it. So if you find it in your hive, it's absolutely devastating.
Yeah.
The bees can't recover from it. It kills the young brood, and the colony slowly gets weaker and weaker. What you need to do when you find it, we need to report it to the Department of Primary Industries, who are our biosecurity experts here in New South Wales. It has to be reported. It has to be reported within 24 hours of discovery. And then your responsibility is actually to kill that colony. You have to euthanize all of the bees, and you either burn everything. You can harvest the honey because it doesn't affect humans at all. So the best thing to do is, if you've got a good crop of honey, is to harvest the honey before you kill off the bees. And then you have to either burn everything pretty much, or including the dead bees. So you dig a pit, you burn the whole lot in the pit, and then you put soil over the top of the pit so that none of those spores, which can survive that heat of the fire, can be accessed by other bees looking, because they can smell the honey that's been left over after the burn, or, you know, from the burn.
Yeah.
The other way is to have the box irradiated by cobalt 60. It's a medical irradiation level, and that process, that will actually kill off the spore. And the equipment, again, is safe to use. So that's our worst, that's really our worst enemy. We live in an area that's quite wet and humid, and it seems to proliferate in our climate. So it's something that beekeepers in our area really need to learn to recognise, to be testing for on a regular basis, and be prepared to act.
And this is something that I think by joining a club, I remember we went to a on-site demonstration at a queen bee place, and they were showing us what it looked like, American foul brood.
Yes.
And it was really interesting to see it, because it is important to know that if you've got it or not.
And again, that's why you need to be a beekeeper and not a honey collector.
Yeah,
because if you can't recognise those pests and diseases, there's a little pest called the small hive beetle. And again, it looks like an innocent little beetle about the size of a lady beetle, but it's black, and it just looks innocent enough. But if it gets sufficient numbers in your hive, it will slime out your entire hive. It's called a slime out, which is even a horrible word. Yeah. And you find that you've got all these maggots crawling all over your honey, it's just the most disgusting thing, absolutely disgusting, and you lose your colony.
Yeah.
So, if you don't, as a beekeeper, you need to know about these things. You need to have experience in seeing them, recognizing them, testing for them, putting things in place, barrier systems and things in place that can assure the safety of your colony.
And look, we're not trying to say don't do this.
Oh no. It's a great hobby.
It's a great hobby.
Yes.
But we just want people to be really aware of some of the situations that can arise, and it does affect, the bee populations around.
Not just
your population, but there might be other bees around too.
Yeah, and I think we need to remember that bees are not like dogs and cats. They're not a domesticated animal. Yes, you can keep them in a box in the backyard, and you can call them the girls, and you can love them to death, you can love them dearly, and I do. I'm passionate about them. But they will sting you. They will sting you relentlessly if you do something wrong.
Yeah.
If you develop an allergy, you can die from that allergy. Mm. So it is not a, it's not a hobby to be taken lightly.
No.
It's fabulous. It's a fabulous hobby. It's a fascinating hobby. It's a hobby that you can learn so much. Mm. You can see into a world that you never thought was possible to be a part of, you know, the insect world. But you, you need to you need to be learning and growing and understanding what's going on, not just simply putting a hive in the backyard and hoping to take off some honey every couple of months. Yeah. That doesn't work.
No, it doesn't work. Definitely not.
Yeah.
So I think some of the steps that people would need to take are, A, join a club.
Yep. Join a club.
Then they'll have to register their hive if they do that.
Yeah. So I'm not sure about the conditions or the compliance, you know, in other parts of the world or even, but here in Australia, we have to, in some states it's actually a requirement. In some councils it's a requirement to actually belong to a training organisation. And if you join your local club, your local bee club, then that covers that one.
Yeah.
You have to register with the Department of Primary Industries, or it might be called the Department of Fisheries and Agriculture. Mm. You need to look up the name of your government department in your part of the country. You need to register with them, and they will issue with a hive identification number. And that number has to go on to each of your colonies of hives, so that we know the source of your bees. And if you sold your bees, then your hive would actually stay on that box generally, and the new beekeeper that bought those would then add their number to it. You might put a line through yours, but the idea is to know the heritage of those bees, so that if we do come up with some strange and exotic pest, we know where it may have originated, and we can follow that through. So you'll get a hive identification number, and then you're expected to inspect your colony at on a regular basis, but you also have to keep notes of what you find. So it's kind of like, it's not as scary as the tax department, but the Department of Primary Industries do expect you to keep records of what you see. If you have disease, you need to record that. If you requeen or if whatever happens in your hive, you need to keep records of all of that, because they don't come knocking at the door. But if you had a complaint from a neighbour, or there was some sort of an issue in your area, and the Department of Primary Industries did start to check who has hives and who doesn't, then they could ask to see your notes.
Yeah.
So
it's open to someone that's probably a bit more fastidious.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Or wanting to be more fastidious in their lives. Right, you know?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And you don't need to keep, you know, it's not copious. You're not writing a 1,000-word essay every time you open your hive.
Yeah.
But, yeah, you just need to say, you know, how were the bees today? Did I see any pests and diseases? What did I do about it? Am I suspicious of something? Do I, you know, what's going to be my action? Do I need to speak to somebody who's got more experience? Do I need to make up a slide and send it off to the lab and have it tested to see if it is one of these diseases that is reportable?
So, Leonie, we've now understood from what you've just said what's involved in beekeeping.
Okay.
So they've decided that they want to go ahead.
Yep.
What do they do?
Okay. So you need to acquire some bees.
How do they do that?
Well, the first thing you usually do is, you've got two ways, but the first thing to do is to buy what we would call a nucleus colony. Nucleus just means a small colony. So it's generally somewhere between about 6,000 and 10,000 bees, and that will be made up of usually a new season's queen, so she's a very young, very productive, very fertile queen, and several thousand worker bees, all of whom are female. All of the workers are female, and then they're in the hive. There are also drones. The drones are the male bees, and you'll get a small number in a nucleus colony. You might get 1% of drones.
Okay.
And basically their job is to sit around, look handsome, eat honey, and go out for a few hours each day and chase virgin queens. So the colonies through the spring, summer and autumn will contain some drones.
Yeah.
And when you buy your little nucleus colony, they'll have some in it. You can also buy a package of bees, which is not so great as a nucleus, that they haven't grown together as a unit. A package of bees is a whole bunch of unrelated bees and a queen that are put together into a package and sent to you, often through the mail. It's a very, very strange way, a very strange parcel to receive. And then you just have to hope that these often unrelated bees and a queen that they have had nothing to do with will get on enough to form their own little colony. So I generally suggest buy a nucleus, start small, and buy yourself a hive. And in Australia, we'd usually choose a timber hive, which will comprise a base, two boxes, and a lid. And when you get your little nucleus colony, it will slowly expand. In fact, it'll rapidly expand with your young, very fertile queen. And you'll find that you need to move those bees from a small nucleus box into your full-size single box of bees at that stage. And then they'll continue to expand. And then eventually in the spring and the summer, when we've got a flow of nectar in the trees, when all the trees and flowers and gardens and parklands are all starting to flower, then there'll be such a surplus of nectar out there that you put a second box on top, and that is called your honey super. So the queen and all of the basic colony are in that bottom box, and they are breeding up. She's breeding up big numbers, and then they move up into that second box that's sitting above them, and all of the forager bees go out and they collect lots and lots of pollen and lots of nectar. The nectar is a very sweet liquid that the plants produce purely to attract pollinators, whether that be bees or birds or beetles or bats or the bee things that start with B. They just produce this beautiful sweet syrup that attracts the pollinators in, and what they're really asking them to do is to pick up some pollen, which is the basically it's sperm, it's the male part of the flower. They collect it on their legs accidentally while they're collecting the nectar, and then they go on to the next flower, and that and then some of that pollen from the first flower is deposited accidentally again onto the second flower, and then the flowers are happy because they've now been pollinated. So they'll produce fruit and seed, and in the meantime the bee has done beautifully. She's got all this nectar that she's collected, and she's got all this pollen that she's collected on her body, and she flies back to her nest, and she stores those in her nest. That's what I'd say to people. Start off small, with a nucleus colony, and grow with your colony. As your knowledge grows and your colony grows, you've got a colony that you can watch and enjoy and see them coming and going. And, as your knowledge increases and they're increasing, everybody is benefiting.
Yeah, I think those are valid points, what you're making there. And also, we've reiterated this a number of times, but find a mentor, join a bee club.
Absolutely.
Know what you're getting into.
Yeah.
And see if it's comfortable for you.
Totally. And, if you find that you get stung and it hurts and you swell up, then reconsider. This is maybe not the hobby for you. That's one of the great things about being part of a bee club. You can go along, you can work with people, you can find out if this is something that you're really, really passionate about.
Try before you buy, sort
exactly.
of thing, right?
And that's another thing too. You know, honeybees, they're not like you can't drop them off at the pound you can't take the, you know, your animals. If you don't want them, somebody will buy them from you, but they're not easy to get rid of. They're little stingy insects. So you need to be really clear that it's something that you want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Leonie, I really appreciate you coming on to Beaming Green, and you've shared a lot of information. I look forward to chatting more.
Definitely.
About a bit more advanced levels of beekeeping at some stage anyway.
Yeah, we've barely scratched the surface.
Yeah, we did.
So there's
a lot to learn.
There is indeed.
Believe me.
Yeah. So thank you, Jeremy. It's been great.
Good on you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for being part of the Beaming Green podcast. The music for this podcast is produced by Dave Weir. Now, we need more people to get on board and raise awareness about sustainability and climate change. The more of us that are shining the light on these issues, the more governments and business leaders will listen. We would love you to subscribe to our podcast and share and engage in social media so that we can get some traction. Let's support one another and envision a brighter future. Thanks for listening. See you next week.